Well, I was asked to lead this discussion. I think I know what discussion means. I'm not sure I know what lead means in this context of this particular group. So Joe and Sean asked me to start off with a little 20-minute talk. In that 20-minute time, I thought, really, I can't do much about to describe particular theories of the initial condition, but I thought I'd give you a general pep talk on why the state in cosmology is an important thing for you to be thinking about. So the operating assumption in quantum cosmology is certainly that the universe is a quantum mechanical system. We perhaps have little direct evidence for peculiarly quantum mechanical phenomena on large or even familiar scales, but there's no evidence that the phenomena that we do see couldn't be described in quantum mechanical terms and explain its universal regularities explained by quantum mechanical theories such as string theory. If this assumption is correct, then the universe must have a quantum state. It's in some quantum state, the whole thing. And the question is, of quantum cosmology is, what is it? In laboratory science, we're used to thinking of the quantum state of a measured subsystem, for example, as a kind of summary of the part of the universe outside the subsystem we're studying. So for example, if you talk about it, making measurements on a subsystem consisting of a single electron, a single particle, then you use the state to describe, for example, how the experimental situation might have been set up, that part of the universe to the past in time of the regime in which you're discussing it. But in cosmology, sort of by definition, there's no rest of the universe to pass the specification of the state off to. If it's therefore not just a simple, it is a boundary condition, but it's not something which we can determine by experiment or observation. It has to be part of the fundamental laws of physics themselves.
Jim, I'm sorry, but is point two supposed to be obvious?
What's point two? Oh, this point two.
Yeah.
If the system has a is a quantum mechanical system, which of course could be wrong, then it has to have a state.
So it follows from point one, in your opinion?
Yes. And so in making this discussion, it's useful to keep in mind a kind of simple model, which is the model of a universe in a box. So we imagine a box, and we have matter fields on the inside. It's maybe 20,000 megaparsecs on a side, so it's outside of our horizon. And I'm not claiming the universe is accurately modeled by this, although it's not such a bad approximation if the box is expanding. Late in the universe, that is after the Planck scale, but it does allow me to just touch base with the familiar apparatus of Hilbert space, the Schrodinger equation, and so forth, for the purposes of making this discussion. I don't think the conclusions are much changed at the general level I'm going to be talking. The only thing I need is it's a closed system. There's nothing outside which is making a measurement of the box or discussing what's going on inside. Everything, you, the observers, apparatus, are included inside the box. The most general objective of any quantum mechanical theory it's less windy on this side of the projector, is the prediction of probabilities of alternative coarse-grain histories of the closed system. So for example, if you're talking about the motion of the Earth around the Sun, you might be interested in the probabilities for various orbits it might take around the Sun. Of course, you, in a particular situation, you hope that there'll be a high probability for it moving on an orbit which is governed by Newton's laws. Not every set of alternative histories can be assigned probabilities in quantum mechanics because of quantum interference. And that's illustrated very clearly in the two-slit experiment. If you have the famous two-slit experiment and you detect electrons at a particular point y on the second screen, then there are two possible histories by which they could have reached y, two coarse-grained histories. They might have gone through the upper slit or the lower slit, but it's inconsistent in general to assign probabilities to those two alternatives because in quantum mechanics, probabilities are squares of amplitudes. And in general, the usual probability sum rule, that the probability to arrive at y should be the sum of the probability to go through u and l, won't be satisfied because the square of a sum is not the sum of the squares. So some rule is needed to determine which sets of histories can be assigned probabilities and which cannot. And in the usual quantum mechanics of measured subsystems, that rule is you can assign probabilities to histories that have been measured, because if you measured which slit it went through, the interference is destroyed, the sum rules are obeyed, and as it said, it's all consistent.
So in the quantum mechanics of a closed system, do you view that rule as part of the theory or as an extra?
As part of the theory. So I'm about to announce what the rule is in the modern version of this, which is very simple. First of all, the inputs to the process of what the rule are just the two things which we have in the box, the Hamiltonian governing the dynamics and the state of the system, which you presume are supplied by theory.
But the detector on the screen is included.
Yeah. No detectors up here yet. Oh, the detector on the other screen, yes. Everything is included. The modern version of this is quite a simple rule, which is due to Griffiths, Amos, Gell-Mann, and others, is that probabilities are assigned to exactly those sets of alternative histories for which the interference is negligible as a consequence of the system's Hamiltonian initial condition. So if you're given the state, right, you calculate what doesn't interfere, and that's what you can assign probabilities to. So measurements, right, for example, can be described, but they don't play some fundamental role in setting up the theory, and that extends the range of things which you can calculate, for example, to calculating probabilities of, say, density fluctuations in the early universe where there was nobody around to, or the moon, for example, when nobody was looking at it, when there was nobody around to make measurements. Just so you don't believe. So all you need is to implement that rule, just a little mathematics, and here it is. The input is the state of the system in the Hamiltonian, provided by theory. Probabilities for alternatives at one moment of time are represented in this way. The probability of, we have a sequence of alternatives, for example, definite ranges of position of the Earth moving around the sun. These alternatives are represented by a set of orthogonal exhaustive projection operators, say down on the different possible ranges, and the probability of each range is given by the projection operator applied to psi squared. Histories in this simple model are sequences of alternatives at a series of times, say a set of positions at different times, and the corresponding operator which represents them is a chain of projections ordered in time. Branch state vectors can then be constructed for each history by applying the operator representing the history to psi. So there'll be, for example, there'll be a history in which the Earth took one orbit around the sun, and a different history in which it took a different orbit. And these add up to psi so that you've just resolved the state vector of the universe, if you like, into trajectories. The probabilities of those histories are given by, in the same fashion, by the square of this operator, but they're only decoherent, as I mentioned, or you can only assign probabilities when the interference vanishes, which in a simple case just means these branch state vectors are orthogonal.
What about all those that can't have probabilities?
The theory doesn't assign any probabilities to them, and it doesn't need to, right? Because, for example, in situations where things are actually measured, the decoherence, as I illustrated in the case of the two-slit experiment, does occur. The very wide spectrum of things which decohere in the universe. Right. If you take a dust grain.
But you don't assign probability amplitudes to the others. You don't worry about the others.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't.
Now, Jim, should I be worried about, well, on the previous transparency, when you had the word negligible, should I be worried about how to quantify that word?
Yes. Let's not go there, as they said, just for the 20 minutes. I can come back to that if you want.
So, is this a condition? Is the last equation in this transparency, is that a condition that we impose on the set of projection operators?
Yeah, it's a consequence of this condition that the probability sum rules, right, that I, for example, outlined in the case of the two-slit experiment, are satisfied. So it guarantees those. It's slightly stronger than that, right, but it's the natural notion of absence of interference between different branches. There are, in fact, a variety of decoherence conditions ranging from stronger to weak. This is what's called medium decoherence. But it's sufficient, I think, for the discussion just to take that.
So do you make any statement about what happens to the other branches? Or do we just sort of...
No, we take...
Even if you can't assign a probability...
I think there's some confusion. So there are a whole bunch of branches. It's the set that decoheres,
yes.
not one branch at a time. So once you have a set of things which decoheres, then you assign probabilities to all the branches.
But when you do a measurement, and you actually, it's just a measurement.
Yeah.
So when you do a measurement, you actually see one particular history.
Yeah.
Do you make any statement about why you saw that particular history?
No, because...
Fundamental stochastic and just
quantum mechanics, as far as I know, is a statistical theory. It doesn't have, it predicts probabilities, and it doesn't have an additional statement that says, and by the way, one of them happened.
Jim, I think I'm confused about the notation. Mm-hmm. C alpha is an operator or a number? It's
operator.
An operator.
Yeah.
Right? But the P alpha on top, mm-hmm. is that an operator in the
an operator.
Bracket?
Well, which P do you mean?
Small P.
Big P.
Small P and a big P.
P, small p is the probability, and big P is the operator.
Yeah.
So the line on top is a special case of the line below.
You may have already answered this, but is this supposed to apply to only things that are in common contact with us? Or is this wave function supposed to be referenced?
Us? Who's us?
Or to anyone observed, or
to well,
what they call meta observable.
I think the issue of causality is a relevant one for decoherence, but I don't think we're making any restriction at the present time that things have to be in causal contact. But maybe the way to answer the issue is all these histories are coarse-grained. We're not having a very fine-grained description. So, for example, you could coarse-grain, that is, have histories that refer only to things, if you had a fixed space-time, which are in causal contact with us. And that's clearly all that's more or less relevant to us, unless you want to sort of extrapolate beyond and speculate on what happens to the part of the universe we don't see, in which case you have to use histories that are relevant for that.
So you say the formalism applies either way?
Yeah, the formalism
yeah.
applies to
yeah.
I mean, so presumably for a given set of alternate histories, you could have some of the states orthogonal to all the others, and then some others which aren't. And some of them could be coherent.
In that case, you would have a coarser grained set, right, including those that, by summing the projection operators,
right. Lumped them all together.
Yeah, lumped them all together, which does decohere. So you can, in fact, talk about the decoherence of just one history. You just take one history and not that history, and that's a set that you can define.
So for any observation you can think about the universe, you can always choose these sets of predictions or analysis on
this. The totality of predictions that are made by the theory consists of all the sets, right, that are decoherent. So implicit in that is that you will not thereby somehow construct something which is, make a measurement, for example, or make an observation that's not included in one such set.
I think the mathematical answer to your question is the spectral theorem.
It is?
Compose any information operator.
Oh, maybe that I misunderstood the question then. If that's the answer, right, which is fine. I misunderstood the question. I mean, so it's assumed here that if you ask, for example, what's the position of the particle, let's assume you can break that down, I think this is what Tom is saying, into the question of, is it in this interval, yes or no? That's a set of projections. Is it in that interval, yes or no? And so forth.
You have made a measurement.
No measurements.
No measurements yet. Okay.
No measurements at all. Measurement situations consist of things in the closed system where one piece of it becomes correlated with another.
The TIs you do?
The theory predicts probabilities for all of them.
No, but how do I choose the TIs?
Well, what do you want to do? That's a different sort of...
1960, 1980?
Yeah, you can. So that's a different set.
Okay.
Well, generally, I guess this may relate to an earlier question. So if you have sets that do not decohere,
mm-hmm.
are you saying that there is no prediction that can be made by the physics, or just that we don't yet have a formalism that tells you how to extract a prediction?
No prediction that can be made by the physics.
No.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by prediction. I mean, no observation.
Well, so you need the decoherence to get sort of physics out of the formalism.
Yeah. But, I mean, how would you...
No more general sense of...
how would you do it? I mean, you would have internally inconsistent probabilities.
Well, they wouldn't be probabilities, but you're predicting amplitudes at some level.
Oh, okay. If by prediction you mean calculating an amplitude, then I agree with you. You can calculate amplitudes for anything you want. But I don't.
You have to figure out what you meant by that if you don't have a way of converting it into a probability. But still.
We want the probability for what happens in the universe.
Most of the time.
Well, if prediction you mean just calculation, then I agree. There are many more things you could calculate, like amplitudes for practically anything. But, you know, if those amplitudes are relevant for some scattering experiment, you will find in the end that there's an absence of this. I mean, I'm a little bit surprised. This is not so different from the, after all, the classical view, going back to Bohr, Heisenberg, and others, who said, right, you know, you're finished with a measurement when the phases have failed to interfere between the alternatives. This is just putting it in a more precise way, right, and applying it to a big closed system. It's not so very different from what we said before.
No, I can understand in modern age or something when there's a CMB and lots of radiation around, mm-hmm. they can carry away around these phases, lots of things that you go here. But early on, if we're talking about inflation, there's not supposed to be any radiation around, and we want to know something about like a probability of tunneling, is it obvious that will still be part of a decoherent set of history, so that probability is well defined?
I don't think there's not another way of talking about probabilities except, right, for decohering sets. So it better be if you want to talk about it.
Has somebody come up with a model for why that is decoherent?
Well, decoherence, I mean, is really easy to come by, as any experimentalist will tell you, right? Because in any coarse graining, right, you're not following a huge number of degrees of freedom, right? Those degrees of freedom tend to be orthogonal between different branches. So if you follow everything in a completely fine-grained way, then nothing decoheres. But there's certainly plenty of coarse graining, for example, in an inflationary picture, which already presumes classical spacetime, right, at some level. And classical spacetime means you're not measuring the geometry at the level of the Planck scale, but on some, or determining the geometry on the level of the Planck scale, but something bigger. So already that has to happen. It does mean quantum cosmology is a little different from the usual way. You can't say, I'm interested in this. What's its probability? You've got to say, figure out first whether it's actually predicted by the theory.
Is it in any way important here? You said input is psi and h.
Mm-hmm.
Typically in cosmology, you wouldn't imagine that there's a conserved h.
No.
But so time evolution operator in general.
There's some dynamical theory, which I presume you have, right? String theory presumably gives the fundamental dynamics, and somehow this has to be fit in the scheme.
Not in this form.
No, I didn't imagine it was going to be in this form. There are plenty of other ways of doing it, sum over histories, for example, and maybe you'll supply a different way. But I wanted to pick on a model to isolate where everybody could understand it, right, and where I knew something to say about it. Right? So H is just a stand-in for the dynamical theory, whatever it is, and however it's implemented.
Well, in the previous transparency, you specifically said you're neglecting quantum gravity, right?
Yeah, for the model.
Discussion.
Not in life.
Yeah, I know.
Right. For this discussion. Okay. There's a quick tour through that. So the major point I wish to make is some assumption about the initial state is necessary, right, in order to calculate probabilities for anything in this point of view. If you assume that you don't know anything about the initial state, then you're dealing with a density matrix as one. And that gives results which are simply inconsistent with observations. You get infinite temperature, equilibrium, nothing is evolving, there's no second law, and there's no quasi-classical realm because the fluctuations in all quantum mechanical fields are infinite. So we certainly are not ignorant of the...
This means that everything is as probable as like a microcanonical.
Yeah, I'm assuming that, you know, all states,
so
right,
no a priori knowledge on anything you assume to be equal probability for.
Yeah. Wait, is there a different view, right?
Well, we've heard many other suggestions.
Perhaps. Anyway, that's what I'm assuming. So, you can ask what is predicted. So in quantum cosmology, you've got to search through the theory and find out what's predicted with a probability near one. So the predictions of the theory, if you like, divide into two classes. They're first of all the things, the old sets of histories for which one of them is predicted with a probability which is near unity. Those are the definite predictions that arise just from the wave function of the universe, psi and h, sufficiently near one. And those are the things which you can test the theory on. If the theory predicts something, you don't see it. Everything else, right, is a quantum accident that's happened over the history of the universe with a probability that is given by the constructions which I just gave. So presumably there are not very many things that are predicted with probability near one, and that's why you can't get rich knowing just the wave function of the universe and string theory. But a few of them that might be predicted occur on all scales. On the small scales, well, I just threw this out. Maybe something about the compactification of the topology of space-time, and it certainly enters into the construction of the effective low-energy particle theory. On larger scales, it has to be responsible for classical space-time, the state, for the quasi-classical realm, the fact that there's a large range of both epoch and scale on which classical physics applies, for approximately isolated subsystems, and for the second law of thermodynamics. Those things are not to be found in the dynamics. In a quantum theory of gravity, there's no reason for space-time to behave classically at all. Right? There are plenty of states in which it will not. It requires some restriction on the state in order for space-time to behave classically, even in a particular coarse grain. The second law of thermodynamics, as Boltzmann said 100 years ago, can be explained if you assume that the progenitors of today's isolated out systems were all far out of equilibrium a long time ago and have been running downhill ever since. That's a statement about the state. And on the large scales, we hope that quantum cosmologists hope that the big gross features of the universe, the approximate homogeneity and isotropy, the spatial flatness, the spectrum of density fluctuations, and the abundance of the elements might be predicted with a probability near one. But we don't know that until we calculate it. Right, reliably using the correct dynamical theory, which you guys have, presumably. But most importantly, the state is important in constructing effective theories that we use in restricted circumstances. So by an effective theory, you need to assume some properties of the state psi and some coarse grain description. So, for example,
The results on the previous transparency is independent of course.
It's perhaps a little strong to, in the absence of a complete theory, to call them results.
But
it's just the opposite. They're the things, I guess, that I would expect to depend heavily on psi.
Yeah. So
you're looking for a psi which will give you predictions of the form that you presented?
Yeah.
That's the result that you're looking for.
Well, among other things, yeah. I mean, it should give something more. I mean, it should give these effective theories.
And in this sense, is the identity of the density matrix being the identity is wrong with
those? Yeah.
It doesn't give prediction.
Right, as we saw.
But these things could be an
accident. It's possible, right? So we need to just, I think it's clear that the density matrix one is incorrect. So it's possible some of these other things that I mentioned as hopes, right, are in fact accidents. So it's pretty hard to see, for example, take the second law of thermodynamics. I mean, 100 years of work have shown you're not going to trace that to the dynamics, right? Is string theory time reversal invariant? I don't know. Well, anyway, let's assume it's a dynamical law, it's a time reversal invariant, then you're not going to trace the second law of thermodynamics to that. It's the property that things that the universe is asymmetric in its boundary conditions, far out of equilibrium on one end, with a state on one end, and on another end, basically a state that's indifferent to what the state is. So, for example, that's just a simple example of something. So I mixed up in that previous transparency sort of hopes and... I picked my model, right, so it had a time in it, so I didn't have to sort of go into that in detail, because I only got 20 minutes, right, to talk. Then you guys are going to talk.
I mean, it's the usual game of general relativity where actually time is replaced by something else.
Well, we could discuss that, right? I mean, there are a variety of ideas that people have. Among them is that you have a theory of four-dimensional space-time, right, which there certainly is a time, but there's no preferred time in quantum mechanics. That's another whole other story. I'm just trying to get across the idea that the universe, one, has a state, two, that state is important in explaining certain of its features, and that therefore you should work on finding out what the state is.
On the time reversal invariance question, presumably you could set up a formalism as a kind of standard quantum theory with an initial and final state.
So you can. It's not, I mean, you usually don't do that in quantum mechanics except in S-matrix theory. But there are these generalized quantum theories, right, where you can, one of which you can have initial and final conditions. The initial conditions and final conditions, which best seem to be a special initial condition at the beginning of our universe, and a density matrix one at the end, right? But then you can ask how well that's satisfied, and there's a certain amount of observational evidence that's pretty good. For example, you can't take something that's completely time symmetric. That seems to be, you know, so the universe runs backward in time going over after it goes over the hill if it reaches a maximum expansion. That's sort of inconsistent to some level with the darkness of the night sky, with the behavior of density perturbations and so forth, but let's not get into that, right? Okay, so back to effective theory. So here's an effective theory for cosmology, right? A list from Martin Rees with a few unauthorized additions. So coarse-grained space-time is classical. Our universe is expanding from a hot Big Bang, which the light elements were synthesized. There was a period of inflation, which goes on, according to Andre, which led to a flat universe today. Structure was seeded by Gaussian irregularities, which were the results of the spectrum of quantum fluctuations. The dominant matter is cold and dark, but lambda or quintessence is dynamically dominant in the late. And of course, so this has become, I guess, would be called the standard model of cosmology, and there's a corresponding standard model for particle physics. But since I had the pleasure of talking to this audience, I don't think there would be any objection to this statement. The success of effective theories, right, in explaining phenomena should not obscure the need to find a fundamental description. That description of cosmology only works at a certain coarse-grained level. For example, it assumes that the space-time is classical. So as wonderful as those theories are, we should struggle to find struggle to define fundamental ones. In that context, you know, we will have to answer questions like, an interesting question is, what part of what we see is attributable to the state and what part of the Hamiltonian? Or what's anthropic and what's environmental? So an example is the cosmological constant. There are three possibilities for constants that occur in the effective theories. Right? One is, for example, that they're all fixed by the Hamiltonian. That, after all, is the view which we grew up with. The other is that they're fixed by psi in some way. Probability is sharply peaked around some value. Those of you old enough to remember baby universes before Joe got through with it, right? Well, remember that was the point of...
coming back.
Yes. Well, that was a great idea. I mean, it's too bad it was so hard to. It fell into what Sidney called the quagmire, is that right? The trackless swamp of quantum gravity.
Lots of people
there. Yeah. All right. Or the probabilities could highly be distributed for lambda from both psi and h. It could be that the parameters are somehow limited by life. That's what we mean by anthropic principle. If you calculate conditional probability for lambda given life, you might hope that it was more peaked, right, than if otherwise highly distributed. None of these things address the basic issue of you should find out what the fundamental theory is. They're all issues in the effective theories. For myself, I think it's probably, I mean, calculating this probability is not such an easy job. It might be just as easy if you're going to deal with an effective theory to measure the cosmological constant and see what it is, right, and use that. That's, for example, Thomas and Stephen, who written a number of articles taking that point of view. The effective theories may be very successful, but they may only, these fundamental theories may only predict a few things, right? So it's possible, and I don't want to get into a big argument here if I've left off a box or something like that, that string theory might only predict general relativity, gauge theory, and supersymmetry. And the rest is in this effective theory, or that the wave function of the universe, for example, Andre tells us with internal inflation, you don't really need much about to know about the initial condition of the universe because most of it's determined by eternal inflation. It may only predict classical space-time, which is necessary in that picture, and the initial conditions for inflation someplace.
Sure.
Yeah.
So again,
you're not going to put another box up there.
No.
Right.
I'm going to ask you, in this statement, you're presumably saying that there are some things that string theory does not predict.
Everything else?
Well, that's what would put another box.
Well,
in some sense, yeah, but it's not the other box usually.
String theory itself doesn't, I presume, does not predict the standard model because you need an assumption about what the state is, right? For example.
Okay, so that's the kind of statement that you're.
Yeah.
Okay.
What does it predict independent of the state? Of course, if you combine those, then you hope to get these. A situation in which you take all these things and you hope to then deduce, right, the standard models of both particle physics and cosmology at some super coarse grain level.
So compute, for example, the value of lambda?
Yeah, I think you would hope that. Right? It depends on the state, of course. You have to have a theory of the state before you can do that. Because what you're computing are probability distributions for lambda. No sign, no probability. We're computing alternative histories, as Thomas says, which are, you know, different amounts of acceleration.
So if you're computing probabilities, then it's not extremely big. In what sense is this predicting the value of the cosmological constant?
It's not, of course, right? Then it's distributed.
To predict, you need.
I'm sorry. By predict, I meant just predict the probability distributions. I was not trying to claim that the probability distributions had to be peaked around one particular value. But the symmetry between these two elements of the fundamental theory, right, namely, one, a theory of the state, which is what I'm trying to argue, the other is a theory of the dynamics, which is largely string theory, suggests that there's the possibility of further unification, right, beyond just unifying all the theory of dynamics of the four forces, and that is to unify these, to find one principle which determines both. That would be a truly final theory, and in some sense, it seems to me it would be an unsatisfactory, I'm just expressing an opinion here, it would be an unsatisfactory situation to have a complete theory of the dynamics elaborated in string theory and some random theory of the state, because both are equally necessary, as I've tried to stress in this talk, for predicting anything.
Well, certainly some people hope that string theory works in the box.
Well, I'm not sure what will be in the box, but I'm pretty sure it will be called string theory. Anyway, I think it's an interesting question to work on.
Now, Jim, of course, you are always assuming that the truly final theory will maintain quantum mechanics as we know.
I did. I said
right at the beginning.
Right, that I was going to assume quantum mechanics.
This will not be modified.
Well, quantum mechanics, as far as I know, was not engraved on the tablets of Moses.
Right.
And therefore, it's very likely to be wrong at some level, because if not, it's the first theory that will last forever. So it's extremely interesting to find other theories that are different from quantum mechanics and make different predictions, especially because some of them, since we only understand the theory up to a level which is roughly in the laboratory, you know, we can interfere two buckyballs at the moment. Right, but that's, you know, really not all that very big, or these experiments with these Josephson junctions. There's a possibility that if there was a deviation, you could actually come back to laboratory experiment. People who write essays, for example, Mr. Horgan, who claimed that, you know, the end of science is here because it's receded too far from us in terms of budget and other possibilities, have neglected this possibility that we could have a significant revolution right here in the laboratory in a deviation from ordinary quantum mechanics. In that case, the whole picture would change. But the striking thing to me about the history of the subject is we've had it for, what, 75 years?
Right.
So you'd think something was tested in some little microscopic domain, right, in which people don't like, right, on a macroscopic level, would have many different, there'd be a whole lot of different theories around that would agree on the microscopic domain, but disagree on the macroscopic domain. But there aren't any.
You don't know of a reasonable alternative.
Well, right, the operative word there is reasonable, right?
Do you?
No, I don't know of any alternative that's consistent, for example, with special relativity. There are these people that have, you know, basic noise and so forth, which I guess is. I don't know, maybe string theory could suggest some modification of quantum mechanics. That would be even more interesting. Okay, well, the organizers asked if I would put up a list of issues for discussion, although we've had some discussion already. So here are some issues. So we need a principle, I think. At least as I listen to your seminars, right, you've got a lot of states, right, and no idea how to predict which one is which. You need a principle, right, to determine what's the quantum state of the universe. If that principle is inside string theory, right, then you've already sort of solved the problem at the end. If it's outside, then there's room for further unification. Well, how can string theory be formulated to apply to cosmology? There's some information. I presume that's what this workshop is about. How can quantum mechanics be generalized to apply to quantum gravity and quantum cosmology? I haven't talked much about that. There's a certain amount of work that's been done on dealing with issues like somebody raised the issue of, am I assuming a time, and so forth. Then there's the question of what's environmental, what's dependent on the dynamical theory, and what's dependent on the state, and what, if anything, is anthropic, that is, the leads to peak probability distributions contingent on us. And then finally, there's the issue of can the theory of the state and the theory of the dynamics be unified? Well, I didn't quite make it in 20 minutes, but I should have had one of these chess timers. In my time and your time. So now we're open to discussion, I guess.
Let me just start with a question that not really one of these questions. But, so we've heard about inflation, from Andre, this idea of inflation keeps going on somewhere, and the universe is big, or it gets very big in different regions of space. But isn't it true that right here in our own horizon, there are only, well, supposed to be branches of the wave function which are still inflating?
I think, yeah, I think that's right. That's your idea.
Right now, in this horizon.
In our horizon, at these points in space that constitute our horizon, there are, according to your picture, branches of the wave function that are still inflating.
What do you call the horizon? Maybe I misunderstand the question. There is something that we see right now, OSI is about 40 million light years, or a little bit more than that. And there is something which has a size of, you start with, say, initial Planckian domain, and then you let it expand exponentially, and it is 10^10^100. And from the very beginning, two different parts of this domain were in causal contact. Therefore, the real horizon is like this 10^10, whatever. So within this horizon, yes, indeed, there are some parts of the universe which may at present be still inflating, but not within what most of the people call horizon right now, for not the reason, but just because it is basically
Gary's talking about different branches even in this room, right?
Maybe your question is this. I mean, so we agree that it's a quantum process by which the ball rolls back up to the hill and initiates a new inflationary universe.
Yeah.
So that means there's a branch where it rolled back up to the hill with some probability, and there's a branch where it didn't roll back up the hill with some probability. Yeah.
Yes
is the answer then.
Since you're asking this question, you see, these parts which are branching right now, you did not measure them yet, because even though they are branching right now, you'll measure them in the time which is 10^10 extent. That is why there are two different meanings of the horizon. One thing is what is the size of the causally connected domain, and another thing, what is the size of the part of the domain which you can measure, and in this sense, kind of reduce this wave function which, or find out into which of these consistent histories your history belongs. So you will find the answer to this question after this time, 10 to the 10 to the 10.
Well, I mean,
what happens if there is a real cosmological constant and you'll never see at that point?
Well, then you will not appear that much. But it does not mean, and I do not agree with the conclusions.
I'm sure that you.
So why didn't you ask?
But I mean, let me see if, so there's a branch where your parents didn't meet and you weren't born. There's, you know, a branch where the Earth didn't nucleate, right, in this particular location of space-time. There's a branch where the sun didn't nucleate, where the galaxy didn't nucleate. All those things, there's enormous numbers of possibilities, things which are genuine accidents in the sense that the theory predicts more or less distributed probabilities for them. So, all those branches are contained, if you like, in the wave function of the universe, and they're all non-interfering, basically, because... So we're all Schrodinger's cats in Hawking's wave function of the universe. Well, that seemed to have stopped the... people, their minds are turning... They want to object, but they haven't got...
Is that view that you just expressed the same as the many world, or different?
There's an issue of terminology here. I think, you know, roughly speaking, it's the same as the many worlds. But this picture is much worse, right, than the many worlds interpretation. By many worlds, I think people meant take a set of histories, then quantum mechanics doesn't distinguish one from the other except by probability. So some people elevated that to a statement saying all the other worlds are equally real. In my opinion, that's one, don't know what it means, and two, it's contentious. So if you get up and say that, then the discussion sort of sinks in an issue of what do you mean by that statement. But there is a clear statement where the outcomes of quantum mechanics predicts probabilities, and therefore all the different branches in a given set are not distinguished except by the probabilities. But there's also all the other possible branches, I mean, ways of decomposing the wave function and orthogonal branches, which are also predicted by the theory. Those are equally necessary in principle, but complementary viewpoints of the universe, which are all treated the same by the theory. So it's much worse than just all the other worlds are equally real, even if I would allow you to say that.
I'd like to make a comment about your last question,
because
I think we actually see evidence in what we know already about string theory that is actually happening.
Good. And what's the evidence?
The evidence most strongly is ABS-CFT. There's a question about what you mean by the state, but let me try to identify it with the sense of boundary conditions in space-time.
Mm-hmm.
And so in ABS-CFT, we have a boundary condition on space-time that says that asymptotically it's an anti-de Sitter space with a particular value of the cosmological constant. And that, it turns out, we've learned from ABS-CFT, sort of tells us what the Hamiltonian is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that parameter alone doesn't tell us completely what the Hamiltonian is, but certainly if you try to change that parameter, say from one value of the negative cosmological constant to another, you're changing the Hamiltonian. And so that theory exists with a particular state, namely this state defined by these asymptotic boundary conditions in space-time, and it only exists for one particular Hamiltonian.
There's a unique state for asymptotically ADS boundary?
There are many states in the Hilbert space.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. So
But the condition of... That's because this is a theory of a space-time that has a certain asymptotic behavior, and you can consider small perturbations around that asymptotic behavior and make a sort of S matrix.
But
that's what we do. Okay? Those are really small quantum mechanical perturbations of a single space-time situation.
But that's encouraging, but what I mean by the state is to actually single out the state, the quantum state that has those boundary conditions.
Well, I think with
so
those,
it cuts it down.
Those boundary conditions, the answer is there is not a single state.
Yeah, so there's still work to be done.
But if you think about cosmology, the question becomes a lot more difficult to answer and gets mixed up with this question which you avoided answering before about the problem of time.
Well, I could go on at great length about that, but I think...
Because let me just point out something, and this is within a particular way of thinking about how you think about the history of the universe at the very beginning, which I know some people in the room don't agree with. But if you think about some version of a Big Bang cosmology, where you say there's some initial time at which you start, and then you start to worry about the problem of time and the fact that there's not a Hamiltonian, there's only a time evolution operating, then it becomes a little bit unclear what you mean by the initial state, because if you change the initial state into something else, I can take that into account by saying that, well, there was one little interval of time before the original, what you called the Big Bang. Let me change the time evolution operator in this new interval of time that I stick in so that I transform your initial state into my initial state. And I've now got a different initial state. And the difference between those two initial states is that I have a slightly different dynamics. And so thinking about it that way, the initial state gets completely mixed up with the question of what the dynamics
is. But
once you agree that there's no fundamental principle that tells you that there is a Hamiltonian. And I claim that lots of things in general relativity and what we've learned in string theory suggests that we have, you know, special Hamiltonians only in those cases where we have asymptotic boundary conditions with asymptotic symmetries.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, we know what the Hamiltonian is, but that's unlikely to be the case for the version of the theory that applies to.
Well, I don't disagree with any of this, right? There are frameworks which you can use to deal with, for example, closed cosmologies, right, in this category of generalized quantum mechanics, which do have a well-defined notion of state in them, right? And I'd be surprised if everything could be sort of lumped into the Hamiltonian. But if so, that the unification is already there.
Aren't you sort of assuming that somebody gave you the Hamiltonian? In all of the discussion that we've had up till now, you kept turning to us string theorists and saying, you guys are going to give me the Hamiltonian, and
yes,
we have to figure out what the state is.
So are you stressing the Hamiltonian by itself, or the Hamiltonian is a stand-in for the dynamical theory?
Well, if I replace the dynamical theory not by a Hamiltonian but by a general time evolution operator, then it seems to me that you will always be able to subsume the notion of the initial state, at least in this case of a Big Bang. I haven't thought about these ideas where you start off from a big crunch and then that becomes a Big Bang, some sort of an S matrix. But if I imagine a Big Bang type situation where I just say there's some time at which I'm going to start, and I claim there's no fundamental principle that's going to determine for me at those early times what U of T and T prime is, then I can always subsume my choice of the initial state.
And you don't say how you start? You don't say whether it's homogeneous, isotropic, or make any assumptions of this?
That was done with a
lot. Absolutely.
I'm not saying that we've solved the problem. I'm just saying that it's the real problem is the theory of what the dynamics are. And I would claim that if there's a sense in which we have a Big Bang, that the dynamics is not something that we're going to have a natural answer to in the way that we have an answer to what's the dynamics of this asymptotically anti-de-Sitter universe or that asymptotically flat.
But it sounds to me like you're already assuming some particular background, right? I mean, or you're already assuming that there's a fixed notion of space-time.
I would claim that the dynamics depends on the background.
It looks like
lots of evidence from that.
it looks like a bootstrap. You have a wave function which is determined by dynamic is determined by wave function. And
well, that's okay.
No. The wave function and the dynamics are independent, but you can always change the wave function by changing the dynamics. And so you don't really need the two different concepts. You start from any wave function you like, and you just tell me. I mean, there's a question, how do you understand what the dynamics is at these early times, and is there a sense in which we can figure it out, or we have to say that, you know, we sort of start out with some random Hamilton? That's a different and harder question. But once you admit that there's no special choice of Hamiltonian, you can always just say, okay, well, instead of this state, I choose another state, and I'll just choose a different time evolution operator at the first state.
Well, I'll be surprised if that's true, I guess, is all I can say.
You saying that you can imagine situations in which you have a time evolution operator, but not Hamiltonian. Is that right?
That's obvious.
But you must have put a lot of restriction on the word Hamiltonian.
Well, the restriction I put is that it's time independent.
But what's time?
Right, exactly. That's why there's no time independent.
And in a sense, what Tom is saying is similar to what I was trying also to say, that before the universe was born, there was no place to write our laws of physics. And therefore, there was no place to write our preferable Hamiltonians. And therefore, all Hamiltonians, in some sense, they appear only together with the universe. So you must really solve, well, not solve, but to think about the whole system, with all possible Hamiltonians, all possible formulations and reformulations of absence or presence of quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics cannot be primary thing. Quantum mechanics, too, must be also on the emergent phenomena, just like Hamiltonians.
Well, that would be great.
If I said that, Andre, I didn't notice it. I certainly was assuming that quantum mechanics is fundamental and it's not going to be changed.
Well, you're assuming too much of that, because it's not necessary.
But Andre, do we have a framework for analyzing this emergent theory, including the emergence of quantum mechanics?
Well,
I mean, what does it emerge from?
The good thing is that once you have one piece of space in which already you have this established Hamiltonian and established and inflation, then in this part of the universe, everything is well established and fine, and you have absence of chaos and, well, everything what we see right now. But nobody told you, nobody told me, that there is any reason for our universe to consist of pieces with completely similar laws of physics everywhere. And in particular, it could consist of topologically disconnected pieces with completely different Hamiltonians. And I can easily write in your theory right now on the blackboard, which is completely consistent. That's just it. Would you like me? That's one.
Sure.
Okay, so you have Lagrangian of x plus d by y square root of g of y different g, l different l of y. And then plus everything.
The first thing is supposed to be a g.
Excuse me?
The integral d4x square root of something is a square root of g.
Square root of g of x.
It just looks like a phi to
me.
Excuse me? Okay. Well, I'm just giving you a list of.
Okay.
Oh my God. I'm just giving you a list of all, not all, just partial list of possibilities. And now let me check. Suppose I have, well, this L is a function, let us do it like that. Metric of X plus L, which is a function of phi of X. And here, similarly, different curvature, different space, plus different Lagrangian of a different field, phi, phi. Okay? And now I would write equation of motion. I would not be was writing. Let's do it.
So, Lagrangian, I would like to make a variation of this total action with respect to the field, for example, phi x. And what I will find that all of these terms will not depend on this phi of x, so they will not vary. Okay, so this will be one equation. And another equation, dl over d phi tilde equal to zero. And what happens, in order to find this equation, you need only this action. Okay? So then you ask, what kind of particles my body is built of? Okay? So if the particles of my body is built from particles phi, then the theory that describes the motion of these particles is completely determined by four-dimensional space, and these particles will live and move in four-dimensional space. These particles will live and move in five-dimensional space. And nobody told me that writing... And nobody told me that it is illegitimate to use a blackboard for writing action like that. So this is completely illegitimate action. Okay? There is nothing wrong in this action. So I'm just saying that you can have a consistent theory of non-interrupting, topologically disconnected universes with an action like that. So then you ask, which Hamiltonian is ours? And I ask, what kind of particles your body is built of? So if your body is built from these particles, then this is your Hamiltonian. If your body is built from that particles, this is your Hamiltonian. And now ask, what is the value of H? And I ask, which H? This H or whatever. So I'm just saying that these parameters, they are not fixed until you say who you are.
Since you have a theory which is less predictive than string theory.
So it's some kind of anthropic.
Yeah, exactly. That's just, this is the simplest justification of anthropic principle that I'm aware of. Because nobody will tell me that this theory is wrong, because it describes everything. And then once you say who you are, it tells you in which universe you live. That's so simple.
It's getting published.
Maybe if I said that I'm made of the particles that seem to be the ingredients in my four-dimensional reaction, that there'd be a billion different four-dimensional actions with the particles too. Well,
yeah, you just draw your own posterior
axis. So when you said it tells you which one it is based on.
This is like Feynman's equation, right? This is U equals zero.
This is far worse.
He took the sum of the squares of all the
equations. No, but those were all true equations.
Yeah. Right, he took the sum of the squares of all
true
equations. So here, every equation will be true, but for different guys.
No, whether it's true or not depends on what kind of.
Yeah, what kind of who you are.
Okay.
So it seems to me that, if you have this view that maybe very little is predicted from the fundamental theory of the wave function, a lot of probabilities will turn out to be a half, and then we don't know anything. I mean, we could take this one step further. I mean, and say, well, maybe there isn't a principle which selects the initial state, in which case we have to consider all possible initial states on more or less an equal footing. And then even those basic things aren't predicted. We know that there's a...
Well, but the early universe seems to be sort of special.
Higher than that?
No.
Well, from the observations.
Oh, the other branches in which the universe isn't special.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You just told me all the other branches are equally real. Not necessarily.
Yeah.
So.
So how do you compute in your theory, right?
Well, I start with one state, and I make some things, and I take another state, and I consider all of your alternatives.
Yeah.
More alternatives that you cohere because you change your initial state.
Well, I think there's no, if for example we made some observation would narrow us down to one of these branches you're talking about, then I think there's no difference. But they're really superfluous from the point of view of making predictions today. So I
think on a
conservation will tell us what the initial state is?
No, but I mean, if there was, you know, if they were characterized by some different set of parameters, and we could determine it just by being in measurements of those parameters, which branch you're in, then I think there's no distinguish. If you really have a democracy among all possible states, then I think the expected value in any one region will probably be not like what we see, as I tried to argue here. If the branches are sort of different, you know, so they're completely different universes, such that we could figure out today which branch we're in, then I think it boiled down to what we had before. But as if everything is correlated in some sense with the initial state, then we, so something like that happens in classical physics. I mean, from the point of view of an orbit, by making measurements now, we know what the orbit was in the past, even though we might live in some ensemble in which different orbits were possible, because everything is correlated. If not, then I worry that you won't get decent predictions out.
Wouldn't inflation change a little bit the perspective by saying that within a certain class of wavefront states, mm-hmm. to go to some wavefront character? I mean, that the wave functions will look very different in one side, yeah. but very similar towards
well,
another
if
end.
If some of these Lagrangians do not well, imply inflation, then you can just erase them from the blackboard. Because you cannot be viewed from the particles.
No, I didn't want to make this kind of thing, but what I'm saying, I don't know, please correct me, that the point of view of inflation classically is that you wash out some initial, the details of some initial state.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That should also happen quantum mechanics. If you start with different quantum states, it also evolves more or less within a certain class of initial states. You should always evolve towards the same. Or no.
But there was something striking in Andre's
talk, which is that we were basically with our during inflation, the density matrix is basically one because every state was populated proportional to its desiderator. Right? That was your wave function, well, actually the Hawking's wave function, has the interpretation that every state appears with a probability proportional to its entropy. So it's not just that during that time your density matrix is one.
Well, I would hesitate classifying whatever I'm saying in terms of probability and density metric, at least because when you are in the realm of self-reproducing external inflation, mm-hmm. then this ascribing probabilities to given trajectories, given the fact that there are infinitely many of them, becomes kind of mm-hmm. ambiguous.
You're a state, though, right? You're a state.
Yeah, so I don't know whether we can characterize them by state matrix. And here, I think that the questions which Tom is asking, from which perspective we actually can even ask this question, because if there are some parts that are inaccessible to us, then do they belong to our understanding of probability? Because mm-hmm. if you think about some many observers, I gave each of them lock and let them watch, and then they never communicate. But if they never communicate, they will never inform each other about these probabilities. So to which extent this calculation of density matrix is really real and unambiguous?
But Joe, are the gravitational degrees of freedom included in your density matrix?
Well, you know, I don't know what the sider entropy is, because I don't know what those degrees of freedom, no one knows what those degrees are, but if you just naively take this thing which
You're just interpreting that as purely a count of a number of states.
If you interpret it as a count of a number of states, then it's
which yeah. I believe it is approximately, but it's actually a thermal entropy. Right? Mm-hmm. We know the density matrix is thermal.
Yes.
So it's really trace rho log rho for a thermal density,
yes.
which is not quite the number of states.
I would have guessed.
Well, but it is a difference between these two probability distributions. One which counts the probability to find something at a given point, like near the observer. Mm-hmm. And another thing that, I discussed the probability, the relative fraction of volume with given properties. So these two probability distributions are different, and this Hawking temperature relates only to the first one.
But I would have guessed if you just have a general state, you wouldn't even have classical space-time to define the notion of volume.
Well, there's a lot of states with small cosmological constant, and therefore a lot of states with classical interpretation. So.
But is that a large fraction of all states?
Yeah,
or
yeah, I mean, in some sense, it is almost all. I mean, in the sense that consider entropy grows strongly when the universe has a lot of plastic, it seems like it could be close to all states.
The measure on this entropy, because like, for example, if you, sorry for using this word all the time, but nevertheless, if you do not have inflation, then your typical closed universe have a typical lifetime, which is Planckian lifetime, with a Planckian time, which is typical, with a Planckian lifetime of the universe, you don't have a classical space-time notion. So the question, what is more? It is us who are choosing what is more. We can live only in the space-times where classical space-time is necessary, but it does not mean that all others are excluded. So it's we are imposing us like the preferable choice of measure in which you made the statement, classical being necessary.
Well, I'm sort of surprised.
How would you decide that that's right?
That's right.
Oh,
okay.
How would you decide? I mean, if it's undecidable, I think it's like philosophy.
I think that is a good philosophy.
So I think if it's undecidable, it's not.
The question is, what is useful and productive? And if somebody asks me, what happened before the universe was born? Of course, you may not use these words. Everything is just described with quantum mechanics. But if Jim does is like give a coherent set of histories, like when you're asking what histories, you're already assuming that you have something large, right?
No, not necessarily.
Well, if it is not large, then they will not grow.
If it follows all degrees of freedoms, I agree, then things won't be coherent. But I don't think it has to be large.
I mean, if it is all at the Planckian scale, then probably you will not have a history because you will not have any flow there. It will just go.
It has to be large because in order even to coarse graining.
Yeah.
So coarse graining is
deeper here, you need to have a large number of states. And in gravity, a large number of states takes up a large area.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Entropy now. Mm-hmm. So it has to be large in order to be correct. I wanted to return to a point that Andre brought up, because although this is not at all practical, there is an issue in this picture of eternal inflation that could in principle be decided in the situation I was talking about before, in which there's a real cosmological constant at the end, so that we will never see the entire inflationary path. So if you assume that you have this huge inflationary patch, this whole set of degrees of freedom, of which was all correlated, it's really causally connected by things that happened in the past, and then I declare that in the future, I will never be able to measure some of those degrees of freedom, then I should find that no matter how good a measurement I do in what I can measure, I find that I'm in a density matrix. There's no way that I can get a pure state by the measurements that I can actually perform throughout the entire history of the universe.
Yeah.
And so that would suggest that when things are causally disconnected from each other, that there are degrees of freedom out there and degrees of freedom over here, and that if they were correlated, each one of them will always see only a density matrix. And of course, if you apply that same logic to a black hole, then you get into the predictions that Hawking originally made about black holes, that a black hole actually creates a situation where the external observer sees fundamentally a density matrix and can never find a pure state. And so my own personal preference is that this alternative picture of complementarity of things that are behind horizons, namely that you don't ascribe independent degrees of freedom to those things that you can never measure, but that you say, no, those are a different quantum mechanically complementary description of the same Hilbert space, the same set of degrees of freedom. And the reason we can't measure them is because our classical observables don't commute with their classical observables. And then you get a rather different picture of what I should be able to measure if I made all the measurements that were possible to me. And I think there's a real distinction between those two things, at least in principle. And this paper you don't agree with is based on assuming that distinction, assuming that the observer in a single causal patch could measure a pure state in principle. I'm saying that in the picture that I prefer, he could.
Could?
Yes.
No.
Because in the picture that I prefer, just as in the black hole, all the states that are outside of my cosmological horizon, all the degrees of freedom, are really things that I could in principle measure by doing measurements on the cosmological horizon.
Oh.
So assuming that lambda will not be there forever?
Assuming that lambda is there forever.
Or is there forever.
And that we asymptotically are into sitter space and really have an event horizon.
Otherwise in the future.
If lambda disappears, so then in the future I can measure everything and my horizon
okay.
expands.
And it's like the black hole that evaporates and then we'll measure later the correlation.
Is it clear that this is actually true, that you're going from a large Kaus-Hunter constant to a smaller Kaus-Hunter constant? And so if you wait for an arbitrarily long time in your future sitter region, is it clear that you'll never be able to cover an entire causal patch from the past? It's not obvious to me, because it seems to me that in some sense the horizon size of the higher Kaus-Hunter constant is smaller.
Yeah, it's not the horizon of the cosmological constant. That has nothing to do with it. In inflation, you assume that the region that is causally connected by things that happened in the past is the entire inflationary patch. Okay, so you have this tiny little region,
right?
Okay, and you blow it up by inflation to some huge size, and that entire patch is actually causally connected by things that happened in the past.
But that's
so it doesn't have
that's just a little piece of the sitter space. That's just the sitter space. You're not blowing up. You're just taking a piece of the sitter space.
Yeah, yeah, but you're in inflation, you attribute independent degrees of freedom to different cosmological horizon volumes at late times in the sitter space. And if there's no true cosmological constant, you can actually, that's fine, and you can actually eventually measure all those independent degrees of freedom, because eventually space, everything comes into your particle horizon. But if there's a future cosmological event horizon, that doesn't happen.
Says on this blackboard, there are two effective potentials, and it is not obvious that it's two, because they're different by 10 to the minus 120 and 1 to the fourth. Okay, and Tom says that in the first of these potentials, you have a possibility to have inflation unlimitedly large, and in the second one, it will be how much AD plus?
Well, for some assumptions about actual numbers in the physical universe,
so
something like
so that. that's what I am surprised about, because these two potentials are indistinguishable at very large values of quiet.
I think that's taking too much of the viewpoint of the local physicist. I think that a theory with zero cosmological constant is infinitely different than the theory of a space-time that has a true positive cosmological sense.
So what would be the way in principle to distinguish between the two alternatives? You seem to be proposing. Suppose I want to describe.
There is a nasty problem having to do with measurement theory here. But let me just make a mathematical statement. Okay. So if it's true that there's a very simple way to think about this in quantum mechanics, if we forget about space-time, okay? Take a quantum mechanical model in which I have some little set of degrees of freedom, and then some larger set of degrees of freedom, and I have a time-dependent Hamiltonian such that initially those two sets of degrees of freedom are coupled together in the Hamiltonian, and then after some time, I turn off the coupling, okay? And now you can ask the question for the little system. If I do every possible mathematical measurement on the little system, do I find myself in a pure state? Okay. And the answer is no, because there was correlation, unless by some crazy miracle, the time evolution before the time you turned off the interaction put the thing back into some uncorrelated state, which is very unusual and violates the second law of thermodynamics. You will find that the little system has a density measure. Okay. So if you could do all of the possible mathematical measurements that you can think about on the little system, you could tell whether that big system was out there or not and had been coupled to you in the past. Okay. Now, the picture that Fischler and I prefer because of the example of the black hole is that when you have a horizon, you don't allow yourself to say there are degrees of freedom beyond the horizon. Every single causal patch has its own completely unitary description of anything. And if the number of states in the causal patch are bounded, then you can't have had a picture where the number of states in the system at some previous time was larger than that.
So now I repeat my question. So suppose I now want to differentiate between these two possibilities by doing some on my system.
Yeah.
What should I do?
Well, there's an issue between what you can really do and what you could abstractly mathematical do.
So I should do all the possible mathematical.
Mathematically, you should do every possible measurement and find out what the state of the density matrix of your system is, and check whether rho squared equals rho. Okay, check whether it's pure.
Does leading include bringing the thing to a conclusion? How many, when do you usually stop? By noon, maybe? Well, we're very close to noon. Does anybody have any more comments?
Can you tell us what it was?
What?
The latency assumption you're part
of. No, that's another story. Well, presumably, it has to be formulated, all those wave functions have to be formulated in the context of string theory. Right? So I'm waiting to hear what the state is. So I'll only repeat, although my confidence that people seem to be willing to throw out quite a lot of what I would regard as the ordinary framework, if the universe is a quantum mechanical system, it's got some state or something which is equivalent to the state, what is it? Thanks.